Okay, it looks like everyone's about to get settled, so let's get started. My name is Kathy Bergsma. I'm with the University of Florida, and I'm a member of the Women in IT constituent group with EDUCAUSE. And the constituent group has sponsored this panel session today to discuss the recruitment and retention of women in IT. I'm not going to be up here much. I'm hoping that we can get a good interactive discussion. But first, I'd like for each of our panelists to give you a brief introduction. Let me note first that it seems like, to a certain extent, women in IT statistics might be going in the wrong direction. I think IT has the potential to be a great equalizer for women, but an article published this spring in Campus Technology pointed out that the percent of women in computer science majors has dropped from 18 to 20% down to 11%. And I don't know about your institution, but at my institution, the number of women at the table are decreasing. In fact, there are zero at the University of Florida right now. So with that said, let's get started. I'm going to introduce briefly our panelists, and then I'll let each of them have an opportunity to tell you more about themselves. On my far right is Tracy Fuvey, and Tracy is with Duke. Next to her is Susan Metros, and Susan is with the University of Southern California. Mary Lou Goodyear is from the University of Kansas, and Deborah Keack-Franson is from the University of Colorado, Boulder. So with that, Tracy, why don't you tell us a little bit about why you're here?
Sure. Oh. So welcome, everybody. The first thing I would note and observe with a slight amount of irony is I appreciate the attendance of the maybe dozen or so men we have here, but you now feel the way the rest of us feel in about every single meeting we go to, which is, boy, not many other folks who look like me and are coming from where I'm coming from. So that's what today's discussion is about in some ways, is how do we recruit and retain more women in the technology area, and what does the future look like for all of us. I've been in information technology, I was going to count, but I won't. I will just put it this way. My first job after graduating from college as a math major with a computer science concentration at a university that was very technologically oriented and where all the people in my class were basically men, my first job was helping area high school teachers use this new little computer called a Macintosh. Some of you may remember it. It was about this tall. You had to pick it up by a handle. It was the original 128K Mac. So anyway, I've been in the IT area for that long, and I'm pleased to say that I've noticed a significant increase in the number of women in that field, and I have some thoughts on why that is. I will note, though, that we've actually probably created a vacuum today. Not that the demographics were probably good in other meetings in terms of men-to-women ratio, but suddenly with all the women we have in this one, boy, the other meetings, they've got to be saying, what happened to all the women? No wonder they're doing a session on women in IT. The one thing I want to start out with on a high point, because I do want to note that there's still a lot of work to go on, but one thing that excites me is the observation that this has changed quite a bit in the last roughly 30 years in terms of the number of women who are involved in information technology and at the highest level. And so I'll start out giving you a little bit of a look into one group of CIOs in which I participate. It's a group of some of the Ivy League schools and a few other schools, 12 of us all together, a very informal group. We get together a couple of times a year. I first joined that group in 2002. As of 2001, of the 12 CIOs, only two were women, so less than 20%. Over the next couple of years, and by about 2004, 50% of the women, of the CIOs in that group of 12 were women. And actually with two new positions that were filled this year, this is now staggering. It's kind of getting to be like the demographics in this room. Eight out of the 12 positions, two-thirds, a full two-thirds of the CIOs from the 12 universities are women, which is, I think, interesting and encouraging, even though it may not feel reflective of what we see every day, those of us who are women and men, when we go to meetings and look around the room. But I do think it is encouraging, and I thought it was important to start out on that up note of the fact that the numbers have changed and are changing, even though we don't necessarily see it in every single setting. To me, just to give a little hint into why I think that is, you know, people have talked about the pipeline for years and about the lack of high numbers of women in science, math, engineering, in technology areas, especially as you get beyond elementary school and into middle school, and then the pipeline just gets worse and worse. And so I started thinking recently, I don't think that the change in women in these positions is a result of opening up that pipeline and getting more push through it. And I actually think it's a result of deciding that the pipeline can be bigger, because I think we've moved from a world where the people who lead technology in institutions is necessarily the most technical person in the room. And it's become more a role about business and understanding the business of the university in terms of research and academics, about coordinating and facilitating activities. And that's not a case where I don't believe any of us would claim that there's any gender disparity in the skills we bring to the table, even if the pipeline in science, technology, and math is not on par between the two genders. So I'll end with that and pass it on to
Deb. Thank you very much, Tracy. Next is Susan Metros from the University of Southern California. Thank you, Susan.
People always ask me, what's a nice girl like me doing in technology? And it is an odd question, because I started off in art. My undergraduate degree was painting and drawing, and then I went into graphic design. And there's a lot of closet graphic designers that go into IT positions. And I think the reason is it's really a good background. You're an information architect. It's a client and business-based, so you're constantly working with clients, and you have to understand client satisfaction. You have to be creative. You have to be persuasive. And, you know, it was one of the fields, as we're starting to see now in education, that totally changed because of technology, totally changed when you look at it. I mean, when I moved from Ohio to USC, I still had all my tools from being a graphic designer, and I kept my T-square because it's good for scratching your back. But that was about the only thing I brought with me. You know, when you think of it, it's all on technology now. And the other thing is, I've been in academia and had a professor position now for more years than I want to count. And I think the nice thing about being a professor is you're a teacher, and nobody learns as much as the teacher. And that's something that I think is very important in leadership. And leadership and IT, being a teacher, to me, I equate that as the same thing. So in terms of my background, that's how I got where I am today. You know, it was a pretty simple path. I was a professor. Faculty were interested in using technology. They wanted someone to lead the committee. We put a little center together. They said, we need a director. I applied for it. I became it, and, you know, moved up then the ranks in terms of administration, and never looked back. I really love what I do. And I've done this over four institutions now, so I have moved through institutions. We were sort of given an assignment, and the assignment was to talk about a particular challenge of recruitment or retention in women and maybe a possible solution. And the challenge that I wanted to talk about was that when you hire a woman or hire the person who has the more domestic role in a relationship, you have to hire the family. And it's not just hiring one person. And often in staff positions, we don't take that into account. You see it in faculty positions, but not always in staff positions, and I think that's a big mistake. A division of roles in a family means one person is going to be more domestically oriented in that relationship. And that person's going to come to you. They have to learn the role. They're going to have to figure out house hunting, the school districts, how they're going to settle the kids, how they're going to nest, how they're going to build community, you know, all those things, plus learn a new job. And that's not easy to do, and we don't often give people the ability to be able to do that, flexibility. Also, when you work, there tends to be a lot of family conflicts. There's been interesting research done in terms of faculty and women's roles and women in tenure. And I think it was University of California did a study, and they said, the question was, did you slow down or make sacrifices in your career in order to be a good parent? 49% of male faculty felt they did. 71% of women faculty felt that they had to make concessions or make sacrifices to be a good parent. And I think there's also inequitable expectations between genders. There's a researcher named Robert Drago from Penn State, a professor in labor studies and women's studies, and he's done research on tenure and promotion in academia, and specifically in terms of family issues. And basically his recommendation, and this is really frightening, and I think this probably also relates to staff, is that if you're a woman on a tenure-track position, don't have a baby till after you get tenure. And that's pretty scary to be a recommendation out of very solid research. One of the examples that he gives is that if a father says, you know, got to leave early from work, my son's playing, you know, soccer, everybody goes, what a good dad. If the woman says, got to leave early, you know, my son's playing soccer, they say, boy, shirking her responsibilities. And these were things, again, this was, you know, research that he went out and did. And that's, and in fact, they call that the baby lag. There's actually a term for it. I think, you know, the other part with the hiring the family is one person in that family is sometimes harder to relocate or move than the other person. And, again, you have to think of the family unit. Now, at a public institution, that's very difficult because you're not even allowed to ask if someone has a family. You know, at a private institution, you're at least allowed to ask those questions. And if you're moving to an urban setting, I know in L.A., it's pretty hard to live if you only have, you know, one income. So, you know, you have to think of both people in that relationship. And if you can't ask those questions and see what does it mean to move your family here, I think that makes it really difficult. I'm an example where, you know, I've moved twice now. I've been recruited. My husband has been the trailing spouse. And he's a tenured faculty member, a full professor. And both times we had to, you know, send his resume and hope someone would be interested. And, you know, and he always says, you know, that he's the loser that came along in the package, sort of jokingly. But there's a little bit of edge to that. I mean, I think it's uncomfortable for him. One of my favorite examples is I hired someone when I was at Ohio State as director. And Ohio State being a public institution, I couldn't ask about the family, but I knew her husband was a tenured faculty member at the previous institution. But I couldn't say, am I going to have to find him a job? Or, you know, I couldn't say any of that, but I knew it. And so right at the end, I made the offer, and, you know, we went back and forth a little bit, and we finally came to the point, and I said, you know, is this it? Or do we? And she said, no, there's one more thing. I thought, here it comes. I said, okay, what is it? She said, I'm going to need a comfortable chair. And I said, a comfortable chair? She says, yeah. I said, well, okay, I can get you a chair. You know, you want a nice chair? I'll get you a Herman Miller chair. You know, I was so relieved. I'll get you the nicest chair you want. You know, is that it? And she says, well, there's one other thing. I said, well, she says, my husband needs a tenured position. And so I said, oh, geez, you know, I knew that was coming. I said, but how come you put the chair in front of your husband? She says, well, you know, you have to sit in a chair every day. So in fact, she might be in this room. I saw her earlier, so... I think there's also financial tensions. You know, when you hire one person, particularly if you're recruiting one person and one person is the trailing spouse, they might have to make concessions and not get the perfect job, and that does create difficulties. Now, the other part of the assignment was to come up with a solution, and there, you know, the solution is family-friendly policies and to really push those at your institution. And it's not only child care, but it's babysitting communes and emergency pickup, and it's elder care. You know, I've got a father that's almost 100 years old, and there's times where if I didn't have a job where I could leave and, you know, free him from the hospital, wherever he went off running to, you know, I'd be in trouble. I need that flexibility. You know, you have to think about telecommuting and having some flexibility and some flex jobs. You have to think about relocation packages because it's pretty expensive to move cross-country and to make all those changes, and you have to be creative about those changes. I mentioned already spousal hires and career support for the person who doesn't have the job, whether it be in the university or try to find something for that person or set them up with career services or at least help them network. And, you know, different types of leave packages. You know, so they can do. And I think the result is if you are able to do that and are able to push that at your institution, you will have a better and more competitive advantage in hiring and also retaining IT staff. So I'll stop there and pass it on to Mary Lou.
Thank you very much, Susan. Next we have Mary Lou Goodyear from the University of Kansas.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm the chair of the Department of Public Administration. You're probably wondering what I'm doing at EDUCAUSE. I've been full-time faculty now for 3 years after I did an 8-year stint as the Chief Information Officer and Vice Provost for Information Services at KU, where I worked with libraries, IT, and printing services. I came to IT through the librarian route, got into information technology in libraries, and my first experience with a computer, unlike yours, had to do with punch cards. That's how old I am. I see some of you nodding. You're that old, too. So, I think coming to IT through the librarian route was a really big advantage for me in my career because I was used to looking at campus-wide needs and services, having kind of grown up my professional career in libraries, and I think it was really helpful. But there were three main things that I think really helped me in my career that I want to talk about and then talk just a minute about what I've tried to do for other women in IT. One was when I was a very young librarian, I got involved in a program called the Project Identification by the American Council of Education. And it was academic women trying to identify younger women in higher education that had the potential to be the future leaders in higher education. That program still exists at the American Council on Education. It's the Office of Women in Higher Education, and there are state groups all over the country. I've remained involved in that program my entire professional career, and I found it extremely valuable. The mentoring that happens, the conferences, the just community that comes out of that group has been wonderful for me. The other thing that I think was very helpful in my career is that I got the privilege of working for a chancellor and a provost at the University of Kansas who truly, truly believed in gender diversity and diversity in general and put their money and their hires where their mouth was. A year after I was hired into the vice provost position, we had our annual fall retreat, and we sat boy-girl, deans and vice provosts, so the provost could look at all of us at the beginning of the meeting and say, guess what, guys, we're 50% women now, and he was extremely, extremely proud of that accomplishment. That was David Schulenberger, who's now with Nostalgic. So that support from the upper levels of the organization was I think, particularly important for me in being successful in getting the job and being successful in the job. The other very important aspect was mentoring from other IT women. I was very fortunate that when I was the CIO at the University of Kansas, Kathleen Sebelius, who was governor of the state of Kansas at that point, had appointed a woman state CIO, and I had a wonderful colleague, Beth Unger, who was the CIO at K-State, and so the three top IT positions in the state of Kansas were held by women all at the same time, and we immediately found each other and found camaraderie in dealing with the various problems on our campuses, and particularly those issues that I couldn't really talk about internally. Sometimes it really is lonely at the top, and it's difficult to find places to go and share and get good advice from folks that have some understanding of what you're going through. And those two women were particularly helpful to me in working through issues. Also incredibly helpful was the Big 12 CIO group, which only had two other women in it, but the men were just extremely helpful and generous with their time and talent and advice. It was truly a group where you felt like everybody wanted everybody to succeed and that we were mentoring each other, and that was really appreciated by me. The second day I was on the job, I began to work on trying to fill a position in my office for IT policy. This was at the very beginning of digital file sharing and all the wonderful stuff we get to deal with now. And I advertised the job, and we interviewed for the job, and we interviewed 6 individuals for the position, and 5 of the individuals were women from within the IT and library organization at KU, and 1 was an external person. And what I found is that the external person interviewed for the job much better. And so we hired her. But then I thought, you know, this is my problem. This isn't those women who interviewed Sprabblem, they didn't have the broad exposure and knowledge that they needed to interview well for that job. And that's my problem, not their problem. They're not getting the opportunities to serve on task forces across the campus, to reach out and get some new experiences. So I formed a women's mentoring group, and I invited the women in our organization that the top three women of us felt like had great potential to become IT leaders. We said we want to form a women's mentoring group. We're going to meet once a month. We will choose the time because our schedules are much more complex than yours. But you folks will choose what the topics are, what you want from us, what you need from us. And so those women, those eight women, came together and really formed a wonderful collaborative group. We would show up at whatever house appointed. We would pay for the booze, and you know, they would figure out what the topics would be. We had a wide variety of discussions. One of their favorite activities was what we called the question in the hat, which is everybody would write down their current problem and stick it in a hat, and then one of us would draw it out and give an answer, and then the next mentor would give an answer, and then the next mentor would give an answer, and then the next mentee would give an answer, and we would just all work on the problem until the person could walk away with, you know, four or five alternate approaches to, you know, what they were going to do with that. It was a fabulous group, and I'm very proud to say that five of those eight women are now IT leaders either at KU or elsewhere at the director or above level. And so I really felt like it had very positive results for the women and for us. The men, though, came up and said, Mary Lou, how come the women get a mentoring group? You know, and I said, well, because I saw a need and because they are doing all the work. You know, all I do is show up. You know, would you like to have a men's mentoring group? I would be happy to do that. And they said, well, we'd have to meet. Well, we'd have to give up time away from, you know. That, I mean, they decided not to do it. It was kind of interesting to me that there was this tension about me, you know, being the CIO and having done that. And yet when I extended my hand and said, great, let's do one for you guys. What are your needs? What are your career ambitions? Where can I help you go? They just didn't want to really, I don't think it was a collaborative thing for them. They just didn't feel comfortable in that collaborative environment. So we actually ended up putting together a different kind of mentoring type program for individual career advancement for other individuals in the organization. But I thought that was kind of an interesting difference. So for me, I think giving back has been a pretty important heartfelt aspect of what I hope to do. And I still do lots of research and mentoring and organizational change and lots of individual mentoring of women as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Lou. Next, we have Deborah Kiak-Franson from the University of Colorado at Boulder.
Great. Thanks, Kathy. So I didn't know that I was supposed to talk about my path into IT, but this is how it started. When I was in seventh grade, my mother's gynecologist told me I should take German if I wanted to be a doctor. And so I took German, and then I had a professor who said I wasn't smart enough to be at my school, let alone in higher education at all, so I got a PhD in this field. And then I woke up, and I went into IT, which is where I'm having just a hoot of a time right now. But the reason I'm here right now is, and I can share a little anecdote, of a meeting that I attended probably last spring sometime. And I do have a little OCD thing going on, so I do usually count men and women, and I do ratios. And at this meeting, I looked around, and I noticed that the Johns outnumbered the women 2-1. And then I noticed that the Mikes outnumbered the women 3-1. And then I noticed that the Daves outnumbered the women 4-1. And then I finally did my count, and it was 14-1. And so, of course, I did nasty texts all around saying, you see, there's a problem here, don't you see? But That notwithstanding, there are some real other reasons why I'm interested in this topic. First of all, and I'll start negatively, I don't believe that diversity in IT, and this is what I've been told, is about diversity in coding language, which I've been told. They said, we've got diversity around the table. Look, C++, Java, we're fine. And so that was a little difficult for me to handle. As a former women's studies major, of course, for me, there's an equity issue. It's good for individual women. But most important for my position now, I see that it's good for IT innovation, provision of good services when there's diversity around the table. When things are homogenous, you don't do as well. And there's research to back this up. So for me, it's now a systemic issue that's important. Now, what I'd like to do is just take a minute and let you know that there are people who are working on these issues. Right now, as Kathy mentioned, we've got the constituent group, which meets, of course, back-to-back with this panel somewhere else. But the Marriott, actually, Beth just already ran. Oh, no, you're still here. So follow Beth to the Marriott. And we're going to have our constituent group meeting 4:30 to 5:30-ish. We'll be doing some minute mentoring and talking about how we take that constituent group further. But there are also many organizations around the country. I co-direct the Colorado Coalition for Gender and IT. We primarily research and we look at effective practices in non-traditional pathways into IT careers. And I guess for the better part of the last decade, I've also sat on the leadership team of the National Center for Women in IT, and I'll direct your attention to their website. It's ncwit.org. And what I'd like to show you are some resources that are free for you to use that you can go and take, and my friends, the evaluators, would love it if you kind of checked in with them and told them that they were great or they were awful. But I'd like to show you a couple of them. First of all, if you kind of hover over resources, you can go to NCWIT Resources. And they've got just tons of resources that you can use. They've got practices. Talking points are effective to use. So if you are in a meeting and you want to really convince somebody that this is an important issue to look at, go to the talking points, because it'll tell you in business terms, because we often have to convince business people. There are also academic terms for how do we increase our student bodies, but business terms about what difference this will make for your unit. Then there are also programs in a box, and hopefully that one's. And so that's what this looks like. And what these are turnkey solutions where you can go and get their research-based effective practices, often done in conjunction with other organizations around the country. And you can use those. They've got everything from meeting agendas to emails you can send to people to research that you can use to bolster your arguments. Two that I think are interesting or for us, one is the Supervising in a Box series. And the reason I like this one is that they have, a whole PDF here, a whole number of pages about institutional barriers to advancement of women, but also ways to recruit. They've got checklists. Have you considered unconscious bias? Have you asked these questions? Have you done this to your environment to make it more friendly for diverse people to come and work at your table? Then the last one, there's also so there's supervising in a box and mentoring in a box. So there's also a whole series on how you can mentor technical women. What research has shown is that women tend to drop out at mid-manager level where, you know, they're gone. And so it's trying to really address that crucial period so we can retain them over that time. And then there are just lots of others. I know a lot of us like to do outreach, so there are some outreach if you and your staff want to do outreach, if we do want to make that pipeline bigger, get more people into it, how you do that. So that's what I've got to offer. I love NCWIT, and I think they've got great free resources for you.
Thank you very much, Deborah. That sounds very interesting. I'm curious, of the people here today, how many of you do you think would be in the role of a mentor? And how many of you think you would be in the role of the mentee? What you call it?
Yeah.
So actually more mentors than mentees in the room.
Both?
Yeah, sure. Well, I would be in the role of the mentee, I guess. And so I was curious, if you are someone who's looking for a mentor, what would you recommend to them as far as seeking someone out?
I guess I'll start. I think you first have to figure out what it is you would like mentoring for. I think it depends. If you need political help within your organization, understanding what's going on leadership-wise, power-wise, culture-wise, then obviously you want to try to seek out somebody in your organization who has that knowledge. If you're looking for more help with advancing your career from a leadership perspective, then potentially somebody outside your organization but in your profession would be easier. The one piece of advice I give a lot when I talk about mentoring is don't walk up to someone and say, would you be my mentor? Because that's a little, it's scary and it's also vague because nobody knows what that means, you know. But contacting someone and saying, hey, I've admired your work from afar. I see you having skill sets that I would really like to be able to develop. I'm interested in developing X skill set. Would you be interested in working with me to do that? I think a much more specific request is much more likely to get a very positive kind of response.
Go ahead, Susan.
Let me just add that a good resource is an EDUCAUSE ebook that was published probably about 3-4 years ago by, I think, Cynthia Golden edited on, called Cultivating IT Careers. And Catherine Yang from EDUCAUSE and myself have a chapter 5, that is all about mentoring. And it talks about kind of a process and the different steps for mentoring, the different types of mentoring. And I think it's still true to time. I think it still holds true. So good resource, and it's free.
Excellent. What I should try to do maybe is collect these resources and publish them on the conference website for this seminar so everybody can have access to those.
Just one thought to add, building on the earlier comment, a little bit on the earlier comment Mary Lou had made about when she set up the formal mentoring group for her team. This notion of having it be someone in the organization versus externally is something really for you to think hard about, because there are perceptions that get established whether we intend them or not, and what could be seen as an appropriate effort to help another member of a team by others might be viewed as favoritism or special treatment. So I'd just add that as an extra burden that you might bear as you look for this and thinking about whether someone externally levels that playing field for you within the organization and makes it easier for you to work in the organization and potentially rise in the organization without any worries about those issues.
Deborah, did you have anything to add on that topic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'll wait for more questions.
Anyone from the audience have some questions for our panelists? Go ahead. So did everyone hear her question? She's asking about gaps in the literature on this topic.
I can address that somewhat. There's not a whole lot of literature out there, so it's a gap. It's just one big gap. No, maybe not one big gap. But I think that we don't understand fully why people make career decisions in the first place. And so it's very difficult.
It's the gynecologist.
It's the gynecologist. Thank you. So it's really difficult to determine what are the critical points that can determine success if we deem success being a career in IT. I think the IT field is also changing so quickly that it's hard to say what characteristics or what skill sets somebody needs. So we just don't, I mean, German literature, really? But yet it's working for me. But, you know, I never I never had a computer science degree, maybe a background, but never a degree. And then we also don't quite understand how and why women don't take a straight pathway into IT as frequently as they meander. Now, maybe we can go back to some mythology about women are meanderers and men are straight lines and assign all sorts of no, I won't go there. But that you know, there might – we don't understand that. So those would be the gaps, I think.
Susan, did you have something to add?
Just that it's – I think it used to be that IT – people came up to IT from computer science or business. As we know, computer science and business are to this day male-dominated. And when you look back and when children make these decisions, and there's a lot of research on this in STEM research, which is science, technology, engineering, and medicine, it's in third grade. I mean, that's when girls get turned off to technology. So I'm not sure, it'd be an interesting study if, you know, how many of you come from computer science? Okay, quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
How many from engineering, straight engineering? Medicine, one engineering?
Mm-hmm.
Libraries. Okay. Liberal studies, liberal arts. Okay. Interesting, isn't it? Just a, mm-hmm. So I don't know, you know, I actually sort of surprised that so many of you are coming from computer science, because that is, there just isn't the pathway or the conduit for girls today still. That's still an issue for young girls coming up through that field. But, and I think it's something we can change, but we've got to get there early.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Another question?
So I'm going to disagree. And the reason I disagree is that comment I said at the beginning, that there are aspects of our job that are still about technology, but more and more it's about understanding what the university's business is, research and academics, right? And figuring out how to both meet that business need, so to speak, understanding, right, how are we trying to teach? How can technology help? Not knowing how to write the program, but how can technology be applied to what we're trying to do in the classroom, in the research lab. And so I agree with you that we may not have the pipeline in the traditional STEM areas, right, that we just talked about, but I don't agree that the fact that there might not be deep technical people, women, in entry-level positions in our institutions means that all hope is lost. I took part of your example to be people want to see women in positions that are visible, positions that are leadership positions. And so maybe this change in the pipeline will help to bring more people into those positions that no longer need to be, right? Unless you've been programming for 30 years, you don't have a chance of doing that job. And that's sort of what it was for the leader of an IT organization two decades ago. So I actually think that I'm seeing a change in the number of women who were in the higher level positions, and yes, still a challenge in the more technical entry-level positions. But I think that I believe that that will equalize over time, because people will begin to see role models, right, that they can relate to in the higher order positions.
We had a question over here.
We've got more
debate on
can
this.
I just say one more thing in relationship to that? I've been doing studies for the last 3 years in the information technology security area, just because I'm interested in it. But I've been very, very interested because I found more women in that area than I ever expected would be there. And I've also found a lot of men that don't have technical backgrounds. They are coming to security from management, business perspectives. And I really am, as I've done my interviewing about who gets what job and why, you know, why did you hire this person to be the state security officer of the state of Delaware, who's a woman with a PR background? You know, how did she get into that job? You know, asking these questions. What leaders are telling me is exactly what you're saying. They're looking for business savvy. They're looking for collaboration skill sets. They're looking for
artistic
leadership and management, self-design.
Germanic languages?
Yeah. it's all over the map. And so in some ways it makes me feel like we're limited by our own vision sometimes.
I promise not to monopolize. But the other thing I think we've got to be thinking about is what the IT organizations 10 years from now look like. Mm-hmm. And they, I tell you, are going to look vastly different,
yes.
Right? All these services going out to the cloud. I don't need an army of, you know, sysadmins running these things. I need people who can relate to the registrar, understand what they're trying to do, figure out which systems out there can deliver it, figure out how to integrate it, be able to do project management, be able to do relationship management. But 10 years from now, the organizations we have will be very different. And so perhaps where we are at a low point in terms of the pipeline in those entry-level positions, but I think that factors may result in a situation where that won't be a debilitating situation for women in this career.
Did we get your question yet?
Yes.
No. Okay. Then over here.
Mm-hmm. And you had a follow-on on that?
I have two comments about that. One is that...
The first question was, are we not writing the job description correctly, and are we not advertising in the right places? So that's a synopsis, and then...
And both of those. Hard skills and difficult skills.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Very good.
So the question was, are there any statistics about recruiting practices that are effective, and it should be hard skills and difficult skills instead of soft skills? And I'd say yes to both of the questions about changing the way you describe the position. Again, you can't skimp. I mean, if there are certain skills they need, you can't skimp on that. And I don't have any – I only have anecdotal evidence, but when we do job searches, we're posting – everywhere. We're posting on Craigslist. We're, you know, whatever, you know, because you go to where the women are. University of Maryland, Baltimore County has a huge women in IT, and I'm fairly certain they have job postings there. So you kind of hook into that. You hook into their societies for engineers of all sorts. So you really do have to think more broadly. And then you use word of mouth. I mean, that's the way people get hired.
Question over here.
Well, I think she makes a good point. While you think about that for a minute, that we've already established that fewer women are going into the technology fields, and that a lot of the women in technology jobs didn't start out that way. They started in art or business or some other field and found out kind of by accident that they really like the technology area. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a very good point.
What it means is that your son's going to be working for your daughter.
So we only have time for one more question. So over here.
Well, I'm going to jump on that. This isn't a women's issue. This is a higher ed IT issue, and everybody's got to be in here to solve it. I mean, one way we could do it, we're probably going to have another session next year. We should all bring at least 3 men with us, and there are enough out there. We could pull men. That's right. That's right.
Well, maybe the title, women itself, you know, women in IT, right?
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah.
Yeah, and unfortunately we are over time, but if someone wanted to make a quick comment,
institutional
I see people
bias.
Out there looking for the, I'm sorry.
Institutional bias.
Yeah.
That's all.
We have people trying to come in for the next session, so I'm afraid we have to end it here. But thank our panelists. Thank you very much. Excellent discussion. Thank you, everyone.
And the CG meeting, Marriott, Grand Ballroom, Salon C.